Iran's leader issues a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. Yemeni army reveals the details of a new phase of a large-scale military operation to liberate the Ma'arif governorate from Saudi mercenaries. And Australia's third most populous state, Queensland, warns of a possible COVID-19 lockdown after a cluster of COVID-19 cases. Hello and welcome to World News. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, Iran's leader has issued a congratulatory message on the return of an Iranian naval flotilla from its mission to the Atlantic Ocean. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the return as praiseworthy for the country's navy. The chief commander of Iran's navy says the flotilla sailed through some 45,000 kilometers during the voyage. According to Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, the fleet, which includes the Sahan destroyer and the Macron Ford-based ship, has arrived in Iran's territorial waters. He says the Navy's top priority is to provide security for commercial vessels by sending warships to high-sea missions. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency is set to visit Iran to hold talks on the country's nuclear program. Iran's ambassador to the IAEA, Kazem Gharibabadi, says Rafael Grossi will arrive in Tehran on Saturday afternoon. Grossi will meet with the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, on Sunday. The AEOI spokesman, Behruz Kamovandi, says cooperation between Iran and the IAEA is on the agenda of the bilateral talks. The two sides are expected to issue a joint statement after the meeting. The one-day visit comes following a report by the agency this week criticizing what it called a lack of cooperation on the part of Tehran. Iran reacted to the strongly worded report by saying that any non-constructive measures by the IAEA will disrupt the Vienna talks, which aim to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Our correspondent, Homa Liski, joined us earlier from Vienna and gave us more details on Grossi's upcoming visit to Iran.
This is coming at a very crucial time. It looks like this is an attempt that's being made to try and prevent the adoption of a resolution against Iran, because as we said, there was the Grossi latest reports on Iran. Two reports include two issues that he's mentioned, and he's been quite strong worded about them. And if the joint statement does indeed confirm progress or improvement in these two aspects, it could definitely influence what takes place from Monday at the IAEA Board of Governors session, if the US and the three European countries are going to go ahead still with efforts to adopt a resolution against Iran, or if what happens in Tehran on Sunday would actually change the course of action at the IAEA board, we'll have to see.
Now, the Yemeni army says it has managed to liberate an area of 1,200 square kilometers in the Ma'arif governorate in the third phase of a military operation.
More than 150 mercenaries were either killed or wounded. Also, a bigger number was taken prisoner. We liberated a very vast geography of those areas, 2,200 square kilometers. As you can see in the map in front of us, you can see the green zone that we see here that was liberated.
The army spokesman says the Saudi-led coalition launched 37 airstrikes to bring the Yemeni operation to a halt, but to no avail. The spokesman says the army is working to bring life back to normal in the liberated areas. Brigadier General Yahya Sadi vowed that the armed forces are determined to liberate all areas occupied by the Saudi-led aggressors and to guarantee Yemen's independence. A coalition of Saudi Arabia and its allies have been pounding Yemen since 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians and displacing millions of others. Well, two Turkish soldiers have been killed and three injured in an attack in the Syrian Idlib region. The Turkish Defense Ministry says the attackers targeted a unit returning from a patrol without elaborating further. Other reports say the incident was a bomb blast on a road. Idlib is home to the last major stronghold of foreign-backed militants in northwest Syria. The country has been grappling with foreign-sponsored militancy since 2011. Turkey, which has been supporting a number of militant groups, has carried out several offensives to clear Kurdish militants from border areas. Damascus has repeatedly slammed Turkish violations of the Arab country's sovereignty. Damascus wants the Turkish military to withdraw its forces and to end the occupation of Syrian soil. Well, the U.S. has removed its most advanced missile defense system, including Patriot batteries, from Saudi Arabia in recent weeks. The Pentagon has acknowledged the removal of air defense systems, but says it is maintaining, quote, tens of thousands of forces in the Middle East. Also in a statement, the Saudi Defense Ministry confirmed the withdrawal of the American missile systems. Well, the move comes as the Yemeni army and its allies and Saudi-led forces have stepped up their attacks on Saudi targets in retaliation for Riyadh's attacks and airstrikes on Yemen. The removal of the U.S. air defense system from Saudi Arabia also comes hot on the heels of the pullout of American troops from Afghanistan. Moving on to other news this hour, Israel says it has arrested two more Palestinian inmates who escaped the regime's Gilboa prison. And that brings the number of recaptured prisoners to four. Israeli forces said the escapees were captured in a truck parking lot on Saturday morning. Two other Palestinian prisoners were detained near the city of Nazareth on Friday, but two others remain at large. Israel has been conducting a massive manhunt since Monday when six prisoners tumbled out of one of the regime's highest security prisons. Meanwhile, Palestinians say they have shot down an Israeli drone west of the city of Ramallah. Palestinian resistance groups say these developments signal a new round of explicit conflict with the occupying regime. An Afghan resistance commander has vowed that the fight against the Taliban will continue despite the fall of the last major opposition holdout. Saleh Rajasthani says resistance fighters in the Panjshir Valley will fight the Taliban to the death. He says the presence of the Taliban in Panjshir does not mean the fight has ended. Rather, it is just beginning. The commander urged the international community not to recognize Taliban rule. The mountainous region north of Kabul was captured by the Taliban last week. The group overran the Afghan capital in mid-August amid the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. Meanwhile, a new report has raised doubt on the U.S. military's account of targeting the alleged planner of a last month bomb attack in Afghanistan. The New York Times says it has conducted a video analysis that shows the suspect claimed to have been loading explosives in his car was actually handling water canisters. It also identifies the suspect as an aid worker. The report questions the U.S. military's account that claims explosives were present on the scene of the drone strike, which caused a second blast. The probe suggests 10 civilians, seven of them children, lost their lives in the U.S. attack. That's compared to Washington's estimate of three civilian deaths. The U.S. said it was retaliating against the August 26th strike claimed by Daesh that killed over 180 people, including 13 American service members. Well, the United States finally pulled its troops out of Afghanistan last month after nearly two decades of its occupation of that country. Washington invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of its so-called war on terror and establishing security there, but left behind a legacy of insecurity, conflict, and violence, as well as death and destruction.
The U.S. destroyed things everywhere in Afghanistan. They behaved badly not just in one place, but in all 34 Afghan provinces.
They didn't bring us peace and stability in the past 20 years.
In the past 20 years, the U.S. didn't do anything good for us. As a taxi driver, I didn't see them bring us any benefits.
Wherever they go, the U.S. will destroy the country and the resources there. They may spend millions of dollars to help Afghanistan, but the resources they got from Afghanistan are worth millions of dollars.
The U.S. came to our country 20 years ago. I think their original purpose was not to bring peace and stability, but for economic benefits in a very short time. The U.S. has some projects on Asia, especially Central Asia, so they came to Afghanistan. These projects are only for their own benefit instead of the welfare of the Afghan people.
Now, the United Nations has appealed for an injection of cash into Afghanistan to avoid an economic meltdown there.
We need to find ways to avoid a situation that would be catastrophic for the people and, in my opinion, a source of instability and an excellent gift for terrorist groups still operating there.
Antonio Guterres said he is in talks with the chief of the International Monetary Fund, adding it is essential to agree on waivers or mechanisms to get money into Afghanistan. The IMF has blocked the Taliban from accessing some $440 million in new emergency reserves. Guterres said the UN believes that dialogue with the Taliban is absolutely essential at the present moment. Meanwhile, the World Food Program has warned that one-third of the population in Afghanistan faces acute food insecurity.
The surveys we were doing before the 15th of August indicated that 81% of households were not consuming sufficient food. After the 20th of August, up until the 5th of September, that number went up to 93%.
Anthea Webb stressed that malnutrition already affects 1 in 2 children under the age of 5 in Afghanistan. She said 3 out of 4 households are using extreme coping mechanisms, such as skipping meals or preferring to give food to children instead of adults. The agency's latest assessment says 15 of Afghanistan's 34 provinces have shown less food consumption during the past month. Political commentator Frank Imspach believes the international community has an obligation to provide aid to Afghanistan.
First of all, there are real things going on aside from just the politics. There has been a drought for a couple of years. The wheat production is down considerably. This isn't the Taliban's fault. So you've had the destruction of irrigation over 20 years of bombing and whatnot. These are basic infrastructure and humanitarian things that can and should be dealt with. That's the first thing. The second thing is the entire hospital system in Afghanistan has been supported by donors from the European Union, the United States, for the last 10 years. They were cut off, and the hospitals will be forced to close in about a week if they're not closing already. And what is so crazy about this is that the current Minister of Health is the same person who was the Minister of Health under the last government. He has not been removed from power. He's running his ministry. People are coming to work, and he is saying, my God, how can you do this? As a medical issue, as a moral issue, how can you just simply cut off our money this way?
Now, from Afghanistan, we turn to Australia, where the third biggest state there may order a snap lockdown as the country posted a record one-day rise in daily COVID infections. Queensland state, home to more than 5 million people, has detected 5 new infections during the past day. Now, authorities say they will closely monitor the situation during the next few days to see if a lockdown is warranted. Australia has posted over 2,000 daily infections, surpassing the previous day's record of 1,900. New South Wales, the most populous state, has been under strict stay-at-home orders for nearly 3 months now. Police and military personnel have for weeks patrolled the streets of Sydney, issuing fines to those violating health orders, such as avoiding face masks. Oh, Russia has logged nearly 19,000 new COVID-19 infections, taking its overall caseload to more than 7.1 million. The country's anti-coronavirus crisis center also confirmed 796 COVID-related deaths during the past day. Russia has the highest number of fatalities from the pandemic in Europe, with nearly 192,000 deaths. It is also the second worst infected country on the continent after the UK. Russia has been grappling with the third wave of the pandemic since April. Authorities blame the surge on the more contagious Delta variant of the virus and the people's reluctance to get vaccinated. Ida struck Louisiana as a Category 4 hurricane in late August, destroying many homes and leaving more than 1 million people without power. The storm then moved north, pummeling several northeastern states, including New York and New Jersey. Ida left dozens of people dead while causing an estimated $50 billion in damage. And the United States, now, American citizens are struggling to get by after the destruction, of all the destruction that left it behind.
But infrastructure has always been an issue in our country. Bridges are falling apart every day, and you know, it's so I don't know what the balance could be. But, you know, as United States, we go to help every country. So, you know, maybe it's time that we stop doing that and brought our forces back to our soil and protected everyone here and just stayed here. So maybe we're not everywhere trying to help everybody and spending all that money.
I don't think I was happy with how the Afghanistan war ended, but as Biden has only been president for a very short time, so I don't think he can be held responsible for all of that money, but probably would have been better if some of that money was saved for Americans.
The roads can't handle the traffic, the rivers can't handle the water, and now they're going to start trying to tax you on non-permeable pavement, like your driveways are going to charge you extra because it can't soak up water. They're blaming us on global warming when they could just stop building. That would solve a lot of problems in this town.
I feel that the $300 million a day spent in Afghanistan was a complete waste of money. Afghanistan fell within 9 days of us leaving. That's a terrible shame. That's all money that could have been spent in the United States and other third world countries that would need our help more than Afghanistan. We've gotten absolutely nothing from Afghanistan.
And with that, brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for staying with us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
The worst prison break in the Israeli regime's history is just the latest in a chain of events that demonstrate the fragility of the Israeli security apparatus and, indeed, the weakness of the colonial project as such. We'll prepare for you an article written by Denijal Yejic, a researcher and author, currently postdoctoral research fellow at the Lebanese American University in Beirut, Lebanon, where he teaches multimedia journalism and communication. The piece is titled Palestinian Prisoners' Liberation Shows Fragility of Colonial Regime. Six Palestinian political prisoners escaped from a high-security prison operated by the Israeli regime. Despite a meticulously organized network of colonial oppression, the Israeli regime is confronted with its own weakness, as the latest incident shows. The six Palestinian prisoners were facing life sentences in Israeli prisons. They escaped through an underground tunnel that they were able to dig from within the prison. Zionist regime's forces have launched a search operation. An Israeli official called the incident a major security and intelligence failure. Indeed, the high-security Gilboa prison in northern occupied Palestine has been described as the most intensely secured of its kind. The mere fact that the Palestinians were able to escape points to the fragility of Israel's colonial incarceration industry. For over a century, Zionist settlers have been inventing ways to grab the land and cleanse it of its indigenous population. Yet, they are constantly faced with the perseverance of the Palestinian resistance, a struggle that the colonial regime cannot win in the long run. Prisons in particular are an integral part of the Israeli colonial system and serve as a method of control, contain, and silencing of Palestinians. Thousands of Palestinians, including at least 200 Palestinian children, are currently incarcerated in Israeli jails. This year alone, around 1,000 Palestinian children have been arrested by the Israeli military. Palestinians from the occupied West Bank are locked up in prisons in the territories of 1948 in violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which forbids the occupying power from population transfer. The Israeli regime regularly abducts Palestinian children in the middle of the night. Prisoners are often subject to various forms of physical and emotional violence, including torture and sexual abuse. The Israeli regime's well-organized prison structure is an epitome of the power relations between the occupier and the indigenous population. Palestinian life, as such, is criminalized under colonial rule. Palestinians become suspects through their very existence and presence on their own land. The Israeli regime has imprisoned Palestinians for activities such as throwing stones or publishing poetry. Palestinian reality under Israeli rule is characterized not only by incarceration in jails. Through colonial techniques of segregation and surveillance, the Israeli regime has fragmented the West Bank into enclaves, separated by an abundance of walls, cages, and gates. This regime of terror largely stems from the colonizers' fear of the indigenous people and its attempts to control every aspect of Palestinian life and effectively coerce Palestinians into complete capitulation. The nuclear-armed Israeli regime is a regional occupying regime and child-killing entity that enjoys extraordinary protection by the United States and support from its Western backers. It plays a crucial role in the transnational industry of oppression, marketing itself as a successful model of colonial practices, military supremacy, surveillance, and spying technologies. But the many billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars that are being pumped into the Israeli regime could not prevent the six Palestinians from escaping Gilboa prison. Neither can Israel's propaganda machine or military wars obstruct Palestinians from fighting their continuous struggle for freedom and liberation. The worst prison outbreak in the Israeli regime's history is just the latest in a chain of events that demonstrate the fragility of the Israeli security apparatus and indeed the weakness of the colonial project itself. In May of 2021, following heightened Israeli attacks on Christian and Muslim worshippers on Easter and the holy month of Ramadan, repeated raids in the Al-Aqsa Mosque and an aggressive ethnic cleansing campaign in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of the occupied city of Al-Quds, the Israeli regime launched a bombardment campaign in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian resistance responded with significantly strengthened military capacity. The Israeli regime's Iron Dome defense system failed to intercept many of the rockets coming from the Gaza Strip, which were able to reach Al-Quds and Tel Aviv. Palestinians from the different parts of historic Palestine and the diaspora cooperated in their resistance efforts. Protests in solidarity with the Palestinian struggle erupted worldwide. The Israeli regime had to proclaim an embarrassing ceasefire and suffered a major public relations failure. The war displayed the increased capacities of the Palestinian resistance and showed how rapidly the Israeli regime was losing control of the situation. The events enforced a new equation. They also demonstrated the Israeli regime's existential dependence on foreign backing, particularly on its role as a proxy for the United States. Washington's declining significance in the region of West Asia may bear more unfavorable repercussions for the Tel Aviv regime. The colonial regime's struggle for survival is contrasted by Palestinians' continuous resistance efforts and aims of liberation and freedom. Following the escape of six Palestinian prisoners, celebrations were held in different locations throughout Palestine and elsewhere. Palestinian resistance groups and the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, have hailed the escape as heroic and a slap in the face of the Zionist occupier. One of the escape prisoners, Zakaria Zubaydi, who is the director of the Jenin Freedom Theater, wrote in a letter sent from prison in 2012, "I'm spiritually, physically, and mentally prepared to die for my freedom." Their escape from prison represents another act of successful liberation and strengthens the perspective that the colonial prison system will eventually be abolished, and in fact, the colonial regime also will collapse. Palestinian Islamic resistance movement Hamas has decried the reprisal measures adopted by the Israeli authorities against Palestinian captives following the escape of inmates from the high-security Israeli jail. In a statement on Wednesday, 8th of September, Hamas warned against the continuation of the repressive and retaliatory Israeli measures against Palestinian prisoners, holding the Tel Aviv regime responsible for consequences of these dangerous policies. Hamas hailed the prisoners' success in grabbing their freedom, describing the move as a courageous and heroic resistance incident and inspiring all freedom seekers throughout the world. Hamas also urged international organizations and human rights groups to stop the Israeli violations against Palestinian rights and the rights of Palestinian prisoners. The escape of inmates from the Zionist regime's high-security jail was the biggest Palestinian escape from an Israeli prison since 1987, when six members of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement broke out of a heavily guarded jail in the Gaza Strip. After the escape of the six inmates, the Israeli regime adopted collective punitive measures against the Palestinian prisoners. The punitive measures include moving tens of detainees to solitary confinement, preventing inmates from going to the prison yard, banning prisoners from meeting their families, and closing the canteens. Israeli military forces on Wednesday, 8th of September, launched raids in several prisons, including Al-Naqab and Rimon. In reaction to the escalating crackdown, Palestinian prisoners set fire to seven cells in Section 6 of the Al-Naqab prison. The Palestinian Information Center said the prison's authority moved all the captives from Section 6 to an undisclosed site. Israeli special forces also raided Sections 1, 4, 5, and 7 in Rimon prison, and moved prisoners affiliated with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement to different sections of the prison. The crackdown pushed the detainees to set several prison cells ablaze, particularly in sections 4 and 5. Lebanon's Al Mayadeen television network also reported that Israeli forces attacked Palestinian prisoners in Majdo prison. The Asra media office said the confrontation between Israel's prison authorities and the detainees was at a dangerous stage. The Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs said Israel's brutal attack on the Palestinian prisoners and the detention of relatives of prisoners aimed to cover up its failure and defeat against the Palestinian captives' firm will, urging the international community to put an end to the Israeli craziness. It also warned that the crackdown would ignite all arenas inside and outside of the prisons. The crackdown also sparked protests in the occupied West Bank. Human rights organizations say the Israeli regime violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the 4th Geneva Convention. There are reportedly more than 7,000 Palestinians held behind Israeli jails. Hundreds of Palestinian inmates have been apparently incarcerated under the practice of administrative detention.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now let's listen to Brother Hassanain Rajab Ali.
Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam gives a beautiful hadith. He says, "Inna nasa abidu dunya wa dinu la'iqun ala al-sinatihim yahutunahu مَا دَرَّتْ مَعَايِشِهُمْ فَإِذَا مُحِّسُوا بِالْبَلَاءِ قَلَّ الدَّيَّانُونَ. Meaning Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, people are the slaves of the world, and their religion is superficial, only on their tongues. They are attentive to it as long as their material benefits are provided. But when they are tested, the number of true devotees dwindles. If you look at Karbala, this hadith is entirely Karbala. If you look at Karbala, when Imam says, "Hal min nasirin yansuruna," who is there to help us, to help me? You find exactly that the religion of mankind is like they are slaves of the world, and they only use religion if it benefits them materially. And if it suits them, meaning that it's good for them, they indulge in it. Interestingly, you find Imam Hussein alayhi salam as he's aiming towards Kufa, but as you know, Hur stops him and takes him towards Karbala, for they agreed. Imam Hussein and Hur agreed that they will take a middle road, because Hur was commanded not to allow Imam Hussein to enter Kufa. And Imam said, "I will not stop." So he said, "Look, I cannot allow you to go there, but how about we make a deal that we take what we call the middle path, that when they meet in this watering place called Zulhasam, you find that they meet and Hur discusses with Imam Hussein. And tonight, I want us to understand what was within the spirit, within the soul of Hur, Ar-Riyahi, that gave him this ability to recognize where truth lies, and gave him the ability to choose the finality of his own destiny. What was it that he possessed? And I know that we possess it to certain degrees, but if we do not nurture it, God forbid, it may slip us, and we may slip on the opportunities by which to take ourselves closer to Allah through the path of Ahlul Bayt. So you find that when Hur meets Imam Hussein, interestingly, Imam is traveling towards Kufa, not taking the main highway, the main road. He actually took the inside roads, the back roads, to use the word. And Hur, who was sent by Ibn Ziyad, was sent to intercept Imam Hussein and to stop him from entering Kufa. And Hur was searching for Imam Hussein, so he also had to take the back roads to find him. And interestingly, when he found Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he was basically emaciated from the perspective of having no water. And his entire army of 1,000 men was so thirsty that they were very weak. And interestingly, when they approach Imam Hussein, as they are appearing near his city, where Imam was, you know, not the city, but where he was at this watering place, they noticed signs like palm trees approaching the hills. And the companion said to Imam Hussein, "We think we have reached Kufa because we're seeing palm trees." But actually, those were the flags and the ears of the horses that they were seeing, and that they thought it was that. And you find that when Hur approaches, Imam Hussein has a dialogue with him. And I think it's very important for us to assess and to analyze the practical measure of how Hur, whose name means free, whose mother named him very well, is now meeting the Imam of the time. And I want us to understand that many of these people were not privy in person to have met to such a degree that they were impacted as much until they met the Imam. Like Zuhair ibn Qayn was a follower of Uthman, and he considered that Uthman was right until he met Imam Hussein on his way to Kufa, and Imam Hussein convinces him, and Zuhair joins Imam Hussein and becomes a great martyr in Karbala. So there was this exchange, and we believe this exchange was at the level of this free will, at the level of choice, at the level of validating the sanctity of freedom that God created in us, and that they realized that God created us free and we must die free. That's really the message that we need to understand. So when Hur meets Imam Hussein alayhi salam and he respects him, Hur shows a lot of respect to Imam Hussein because he knows this is the grandson of the Prophet. He knows he's the leader of the Muslim Ummah. It's not a secret. Everybody knew. By the way, a quick footnote. The reason Yazid was chasing Imam Hussein immediately when he came to power was precisely because he knew that the leader, the representative of God, is present on earth. And therefore, he needs his validation to commit his sins. But of course, Imam would never give him that green light. It's impossible. It's almost like Allah allowing Iblis to continue to, it's like allowing Iblis and giving and saying to Iblis, it's okay that you're committing these sins. It's nothing wrong with it. No, Allah condemns it and will be punishable on the Day of Judgment. So we find that when they meet, they start to converse, and the Imam is explaining to them and to Hur that I am going to Kufa. And Hur is asking Imam Hussein alayhi salam, why are you going to Kufa? I've been told to stop you. Why are you going? And interestingly, Imam Hussein alayhi salam says, I'm going because the people have called me. So Hur said, what people? Who called you? Imam says, I have many letters. He said, what letters? I am not aware of any letters. I am not aware of anybody calling you. So notice they were so in the dark with the political situation of the time, because Ibn Ziyad and Yazid and his cronies were just feeding them one-sided information in order to have animosity against Allah, his messenger, and his Ahlul Bayt. So Imam Hussein alayhi salam tells his companions, bring the baskets of the letters that were sent to him from Kufa, and he presents it to Hur. And Hur is stunned when he sees the letters that came. There were over 150 letters, and each one was written by a leader inviting him to lead the community. So Hur realizes that this is credible, and he now it was prayer time in the conversation. As they were talking, Imam said, it is time for prayers. So we will pray. And if you all want to pray on your own, you can do so. Hur replies to Imam Hussein. He said, no, I will join your jama'ah. That right there is freedom. Imam Hussein alayhi salam offering prayers, and Hur, who's on the side of the enemy, recognizes the importance of prayer and decides to follow and pray behind Imam Hussein rather than practice arrogance and ignorance to say, no, we're going to have our own jama'ah. We're going to pray separately because we don't like you. Rather, he prayed with Imam Hussein and commanded his entire army. That news reached Ibn Ziyad. And Ibn Ziyad was incensed when he heard that, because he realized that now maybe the army of Hur also may turn against him. And he sends a directive. And soon thereafter, after Hur and Imam Hussein are on their way in that middle road, that they receive the instructions to stop where they are. And that happened to be also at Karbala. Interestingly, Imam Hussein alayhi salam was so kind and gentle to Hur, which is a practice you and I must follow. That when we see people who are on the borderline, or who are not practicing Islam, we have to invite them to the way of Allah with kindness and wisdom. Udu ila sabili rabbika bil hikma wal ma'idatil hasana.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
روحي كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف محمد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, U.S. researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian science editor Ian Sample. The piece is titled, Boys More at Risk from Pfizer Jab Side Effect Than COVID, Suggests Study. Healthy Healthy boys may be more likely to be admitted to hospital with a rare side effect of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID vaccine that causes inflammation of the heart than with COVID itself, American researchers have claimed. Their analysis of medical data suggests that boys aged between 12 and 15 with no underlying medical conditions are 4 to 6 times more likely to be diagnosed with vaccine-related myocarditis than ending up in hospital with COVID over a 4-month period. Most children who experienced the rare side effect had symptoms within days of the second shot of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, though a similar side effect is seen with the Moderna jab as well. About 86% of the boys affected required some hospital care, the author said. Saul Faust, professor of pediatric immunology and infectious diseases at the University of Southampton in England, who was not involved in the work, said the findings appear to justify the cautious approach taken on teenage vaccines by the British government's Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI. The Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization, JCVI, did not recommend vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds, but referred the matter to the UK's chief medical officers, who are expected to make a final decision next week. Children aged 12 to 15 who are particularly vulnerable to COVID or who live with an at-risk person are eligible for the vaccine shots. In the latest study, which has yet to be peer-reviewed, Dr. Tracy Hoag at the University of California and colleagues analyzed adverse reactions to COVID vaccines in U.S. children aged 12 to 17 during the first 6 months of 2021. They estimate the rate of myocarditis after 2 shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine to be 162.2 cases per million for healthy boys aged between 12 and 15, and 94 cases per million for healthy boys aged 16 and 17. The equivalent rates for girls were 13.4 and 13 cases per million, respectively. At current U.S. infection rates, the risk of a healthy adolescent being taken to hospital with COVID in the next 120 days is about 44 per million, they said. How reliable the data is and whether similar numbers could be seen in the United Kingdom if healthy 12 to 15-year-olds are vaccinated are unclear. Vaccine reactions are recorded differently in the United States, and vaccine shots are given at longer time intervals in the United Kingdom. According to the UK medicines regulator, the rate of myocarditis after COVID vaccination is only 6 per million shots of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine. So far, British children have not been admitted to hospital for COVID in large numbers and may not be at risk of long COVID. While the recent CLOCK study found that up to 14% of children who caught COVID may still have symptoms 15 weeks later, levels of fatigue appear similar to those in children who have not caught the virus. This suggests that children may be spared some of the most debilitating problems seen in adult long COVID. The overwhelming majority of myocarditis appears after the second dose of the vaccine, so offering single shots of the vaccine could protect children while reducing their risk of the side effect even further. While myocarditis after vaccination is exceptionally rare, we may be able to change the first or second doses or combine vaccines differently to avoid the risk at all, once we understand the physiology better, said Professor Faust. On balance, there is no urgency to immunize children from a medical perspective, although if schools are unable to maintain education for the vast majority at all times, the overall balance could shift. If my two teenage children are offered the vaccine by the NHS, my GP wife and I will have no hesitation in allowing them to receive the vaccine. Professor Adam Finn, a member of the Joint Committee on Vaccines and Immunization at the University of Bristol, said, "I stand by the Joint Committee on Vaccine and Immunization advice, which is not to go ahead at this time with vaccinating healthy 12 to 15-year-olds on health outcome risk-benefit grounds, given the current uncertainty. As there is a small but plausible risk that rare harms could turn out to outweigh modest benefits."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If there was no Battle of Karbala, we would be oblivious to Islam's principles today. May 2nd, 2008. If this battle had not taken place in Karbala, we would not be aware of the principles of Islam to the extent we are today, and there was probably just a nominal trace of Islam. Not only were this great event and the holy blood of the martyrs not undermined, but they also gained more prominence in the history. This is an outstanding example. Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and the innocent girls and women recognized the magnitude of Ashura. May 2, 2008. Everyone was wondering what had happened on the day of Ashura. The greatness of the event, the greatness of the jihad done by the Prophet's loved ones, and his companions was not known to anyone. Neither was the magnitude of the catastrophe in which the Holy Prophet's sons and loved ones were martyred, the majority of those who were present in that battle did not recognize the importance of this issue, and those who were fighting for the enemies were so ignorant and unaware that they did not realize what had happened. Those enchanted by arrogance, lust, and animal urges cannot understand what is happening in the human world. Of course, Sayyida Zainab, Sukaina, and those innocent girls and women did recognize the magnitude of the event. This is what happened on the day of Ashura.
Ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana mazlum Hussain, ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Events of Ashura live on due to Zainab and Imam Sajjad, peace be upon them. September 20th, 1989. If Zainab al-Kubra and Imam Sajjad had not fought or revealed and interpreted the truth of Ashura's philosophy or the purpose of Hussein ibn Ali and the enemy's oppression during the days of captivity in the evening of Ashura in Karbala, in the following days en route to Sham and Kufa, and in the city of Sham, then on the pilgrimage of Karbala, and while moving to Medina and during the many years that these great figures lived, the event of Ashura wouldn't have survived and remained as vivacious till this day.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.